Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Today's conversation begins with a simple but provocative shift in perspective. Across Canada, we often talk about Indigenous agriculture in terms of food security, community gardens, or small-scale production. But what happens when the conversation moves from feeding communities to feeding the country? In this episode of Future Herd, I'm joined by Camden Lawrence from First Nations Agriculture and Finance Ontario. Camden is working at the intersection of agriculture, capital, and community development, helping First Nations farmers and communities think not just about participating in agriculture, but about becoming serious commercial players in the sector. Our conversation explores the realities behind that ambition. The economies of scale in modern agriculture, the barriers and opportunities around access to capital, and the challenge of building agricultural enterprises large enough to supply the buyers that dominate today's food system. Camden also reflects on how First Nations communities are beginning to think differently about agriculture, not only as a path to food sovereignty, but as an opportunity for economic leadership. It's a conversation about risk, scale, and imagination, and about what the future of agriculture might look like when new players start thinking bigger about their role in the food system. Camden, welcome to the Future Herd. It's a real privilege to have you here. I expect I'm going to learn a lot today. But the first question I love to throw at our guests is, what does the future mean to you?
Yeah, right off the bat, for us, our priority is, of course, agriculture. And we're starting right now a big push. What we're trying to do is, we hear a lot about food, the cost of food, food sustainability, those kind of things. So what we're trying to do is get First Nation communities and individuals we're more so doing a push on communities for them to be players more on the commercial level, and the kind of the internal thought we had was, instead of us trying to just feed ourselves, why aren't First Nations also feeding the whole province, right? Why aren't we looking commercial scale? As you probably know, the problem with agriculture is it's a game of scale, and unless you're the small guy loving it and doing it all yourself, you're either that guy or you're the guy that's the big guy, right? So we're looking at how can communities become bigger players in the commercial game, and that's also from a buyer's perspective too, right? We talked to the Sobeys and the Metros, and they don't want 100 chickens; they want 5 million chickens, right? So, it's how do we get over that? And I don't know if it's it's risky, right? It's risky, but we're trying to combat that the fear of being large and kind of trying to show our First Nation clients the upside of that, right? That there is potential, and the fortunate thing is, we talk food is everyone's got to eat, and we're not going to stop eating anytime soon.
I think that's one of the key reasons I got into the agricultural sector, because it really does feel like it's kind of recession proof. People always got to be eating, as you say. I do want to talk today also about scale, which you kind of evoked, and the larger issue of access to capital, which is something that farmers right across the country really talk about and need. But how does access to capital play out within First Nations and Indigenous farmers?
Yes, definitely. Capital's a problem for, everyone, right? And especially now in today's economy, money's getting even tighter. Our organization has been going since 1984, and we've been growing farms and businesses for all those years. And we're, even as an organization now, because, you know, when I started, you know, a great loan was a, you know, $10,000 tractor kind of thing. And, you know, that's great, right? Get a tractor there. Well, now it's like, you know, it's like $100,000-$150,000 tractor, right? And it's almost the same thing we bought for 10 years ago, right? So the crunch on capital, and, you know, where we would get, you know, a farm startup a couple of years ago was $200,000, where it's, you know, farm startup now is almost capitally impossible, right? You're looking at $2 million kind of to get going. So we're, for us on the capital side, we're pushing, you know, governments and agencies much bigger than us at, you know, making capital easier, providing capital, but also, you know, if agriculture is a priority in food and that kind of thing, it's, well, you can't get $3 million at 8% and make it, right? It's got to be at 2-3. We all need to sustain ourselves and keep everything going, but there's a point where you just can't make a payment on that amount of money and provide food. Where we're a little different, back to kind of the financing, is, you know, we're kind of the only, if it's a community or an on-reserve venture, for many, many years, we were the only player in the game. We were the only one that would be there to provide those loans. With the change in Canada and Ontario, you know, FCC now will come to the table. The big banks, maybe they're still grasping how it works. And it's kind of funny, right? Because we have these conversations with the big banks and those kind of things, and they, because we're asking for capital too, to grow and help these farms and businesses, and they're like, oh, well, like how do you do lending, and like how do you lend to these people? And it's like, well, the same way you do. They're people. They, you know, just because they live on a territory doesn't make them any different, you know. And it's kind of where we found success is it's almost in building bonds and building trust, right? With the you know, if they feel the trust that we've given them, and we don't need as much security because we're here to help them, and they understand that, and it usually comes back around, right? Where we've had clients go under and go bankrupt, and we didn't even know because they kept paying us and walk away from everything else, right? Because we were there to help them and support them. And
what's interesting here is I think you're evoking a different model of trust and a different model of community, certainly one that I think the banks don't even consider and perhaps can't even understand. And given the amazing work that you guys have been doing in the sector, in your community, do you get that kind of respect when, you know, the FCC and the other banks kind of work with you guys, or at least work in the same space as you? You know, can they not only acknowledge the value that you bring, but also the trust that you've built these relationships with communities that they want access to? Does it allow you to kind of be part of that economic and social infrastructure?
Well, and it's like it's challenging, right? Like, we had a, you know, COVID's changed everything, one, but, you know, we had a mandate before COVID that, you know, before we did any loan, we had to meet with everybody. You know, you had to sit down, have a meeting, whether it was, you know, at the business, at the farm, you know, this is me, I'm here, you know, face to face. COVID, unfortunately, has kind of put a different mood on that, but we still nowadays, after COVID, still have gotten back into trying to meet with everyone and put a face to. And I think in today's world, you know, you can buy a house, or, you know, get anything you want and never talk to anybody, right? Fill out your application, get all your money, and you don't know if you're talking to a human or a computer or those kind of things. So I think there's still a lot of merit and value in connecting and knowing that who you're working with, if you pick up the phone and call, that you know the person you're talking to kind of thing. And as, you know, in terms of the large or big banks, governments, those kind of things, I think they still want those relationships, want to build those values, but it's harder, right? When you get to thousands and or more employees, it's more and more challenging. We're still a team of seven people. We're not huge. So we have that ability to be more connected, more involved. It is challenging, right? It also in us, like we service the whole province. So, you know, for one of us to get up to the Sioux or Thunder Bay, you know, it's not easy, but we do go up there every once in a while and visit our odd clients. In building those relationships, it's definitely helped us out in terms of, you know, building that trust you were talking about, right? It's different models than, you know, we're not for profit, where the banks are for profit, right? So we're more in the mindset of, you know, we're not here to make the money, we're here to help you, or help the client, let's say. And our goal is helping the client, not, you know, how much money can we make off of starting this farm, right?
You know, I might reckon that one of the benefits of a smaller organization is you're not isolated the way people in large enterprises or banks are kind of compartmentalized and only see a little piece. Whereas you really get a sense, I'm assuming, of the Ontario Indigenous agricultural sector, of what different First Nations, different scale of operations. Can you share that? Can you give us a sense of kind of what's going on there and what the landscape looks like?
Well, and that's kind of what we're working on right now, right? It's the unfortunate thing is when you look at First Nation communities, and I don't have a vast knowledge of, you know, outside of Ontario pretty well because I've been so versed in learning them all in Ontario. But if you look at Ontario, for example, a lot of our First Nation communities are now in the worst spots for agriculture, right? So it's, you know, so now it's like, well, luckily with technology and those kind of thing, well, the advancements in technology, we can now greenhouses, C-can type growing facilities. There's potential to create operations kind of anywhere, but it's still limited to what a community can do, right? So you're not gonna, you know, so we have a successful operation down in southern Ontario who's a cash cropper, and they grow or work, you know, 2,000 acres. But a community up on the North Shore is not going to be like, well, we want to be like them. Well, you can't. You live on a pile of rocks, right? That's not an option, right? So it's a lot of it in right now what we're working with communities in trying to, well, what can you do, right? So then the North Shore guys, it's like, well, you're prime for maple syrup, right? Like, let's see where that can go. But it's also working with the community and what they want to do, right? Because the other side to this is employment, right? So it's the lack of employment in a lot of First Nation communities. So agriculture's a lot of labor, usually. So it's what does the community want to do? So once, if we can get that support to get the employment in, our idea is to try to create a large commercial operation. Be it, you know, your community is the specialist in this, right? And take that running. And then the other idea is, usually First Nations are kind of clumped together. So it's, you know, how can, like, say these three work together in maybe a project, in that these guys have the pasture, so they're going to grow the beef, and then, well, you guys aren't as big, but you could put up the processing facility, and we'll help you get federally approved, so it's only going a mile down the road, and it's here, and then these guys maybe are packaging, you know. So it's just how can we work together, and that's kind of our new initiative, in what we're trying to put together anyways, and then how can that then go outwards into the province, not only help that First Nation and the local First Nations, but then you also help the, you know, and the cool thought that we thought was, well, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, all the First Nation communities helped the entire province, right? To kind of back to, you know, why can't we be the leaders? We're looked at to, you know, as, well, what did you used to do? But it's like, we're past what we used to do, unfortunately, right? We're, you know, so how can we move forward and be back to kind of leaders in what we're doing now?
Wow, that really raises a brilliant insight into the barriers to entry that people right across the country face when it comes to agriculture. Except again, you're evoking a really community-centric model in which, rather than think about the farmer as this hero on their own on a quest, instead it's a community project in which, you know, the farmer is not acting alone, but has the support of, you know, many hands making for a lighter load. How can we lower those barriers to entry, and are you essentially making an on-ramp to the agricultural sector as a whole?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, and I'm not just talking First Nation communities, like if we looked at, you know, a small town, right? I grew up in a small town, and let's say that small town said, oh, we're all going to work together to do this, you know, that would be well more efficient than, you know, the one guy that has the monstrosity, and we're all, you know. Like I grew up on a small farm, right? And it's I'm only 35, but when all our friends kind of had farms and we all kind of worked together and did that kind of, you know, I would go help, you know, my friend's dad do hay, and then we'd all go and help his dad do hay, right? We all had our small little farms. Where now, if I look at my parents, it's one guy owns the whole concession, and he comes in with the tractor that cuts, you know, three rows at once, and, you know, the square bales are, you know, a ton kind of thing. But it's, I think agriculture, we've gotten out of kind of the, I don't know, the kind of the small scale, helping each other, working together. I mean, maybe not, maybe we all still kind of work together. My thought is First Nation communities are kind of already close-knit. You know, there's, in any community, we all have our struggles working together. But, like, if the community made the plan, the thought would be, you know, if we all do this together, and, like, First Nation communities do projects. And someone said, well, why aren't they doing agricultural projects? And our opinion was, well, no one's pitched or presented that it's a good idea. Right? Like, you should do mining, or you should do, you know, those kind of things. But the reason they're doing them is because someone said, hey, it's a good idea, and these are the benefits, right? So we're taking the approach of, well, we should do agriculture. It's a good idea. Here's the benefits. Right? And there's a lot of off, I don't want to say kickoffs or kind of sub, to doing a commercial agricultural operation, there's a lot of little, I call it like the waste, right? The waste that, you know, the chickens that aren't big enough, or the vegetables that don't look pretty, right? That could feed that community or surrounding communities.
I'm personally a big fan of waste diversion and what the industry calls food upcycling. I think it's abhorrent how much food we end up throwing out just because we can't get it to people who want to eat it. And you're really bringing about this kind of sense of innovation that, because of the difficult growing conditions, because of the displacement that has First Nations on land that may not have been their choosing, there really is a lot of innovation and resilience going on. I mean, if you can figure out how to grow food anywhere in Canada's north, that can be applied quite widely. So it strikes me there's a real leadership opportunity, especially when it comes to maybe smaller agricultural operations, being able to experiment, being able to try new stuff. I'm curious to hear your thoughts in this regard.
Yeah, well, and there's tons of initiative. Like we're even also just finding out about a lot of things that are on the go. Like there's a community up in Northern Ontario that just planted, I think it was, and I don't know the exact number, but let's say it's 100 and some fruit trees, and it's all in a test to be like, well, no one's ever planted fruit trees over here. We have no idea. They're cold climate trees, but, you know, no one's thought, oh, well, let's grow fruit up here, right? You know, no one knows. So there is a lot of, you know, kind of experimental in stuff in the works. And then there's definitely so many challenges. So it is going to be hard, but like you said, right? If a community figures out, hey, you know, this worked great up here, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, the idea would be that, well, why don't all these five communities in this area that are in the same, you know, won't they all do it? And then we fly it down. You know, like it's, I don't know, we're not going to know till we try. That was our thought, you know, because we sat down and it's, because we always had the question, the big question we asked was, well, what are you guys doing for, you know, you guys are the ag guys, you know, what are you doing for food security? How do we, as a community, how do we become food secure, you know, and self-sufficiency, other big word, which, you know, and today I don't think we can be completely like a community, right? We've gotten to the numbers where we can't be self-sufficient, especially I live in a First Nation community, and it's, you know, we have 3,000 members in the community, but we're like, the thought of if, you know, if we did something where we're growing this big farm and we're feeding 3,000 people for free, the 12,000 members, you think they're just going to be like, well, what, you know, I'm coming back. I want free food, right? So it's like all of a sudden, okay, so now we're feeding 12,000. That's not possible in the land size we have. So it's like, well, what can we do that's in our land size? What can we do that's going to be, we're going to be experts in this, and then they're going to be experts, and they're going to be experts, and, you know, and then we pile that together, and it's, oh, we're feeding, you know, maybe we're feeding the province, right? Or I mean, even that's a,
what?
Ontario's so populated, but
you raise a really important point in terms of the on-res versus off-res populations of various First Nations and the extent to which they can kind of leverage those kind of relationships and kind of extend the agricultural operations beyond the community and do the kind of marketing and outreach that traditional farmers kind of do. But in this case, with, again, the power of community, I'm curious if there are advantages to the reality that Indigenous folks, whether from specific nations or in terms of just larger communities, as it happens in urban centers, whether they're a kind of resource that can be tapped into when it comes to advancing Indigenous agriculture as a whole.
Yes, definitely. They definitely are. The province in the world, technically. But believe it or not, in agriculture, most of the agricultural startups that we have are off the reserve due to the kind of the restraint of land in a community, right? So especially in Southern Ontario, most of the communities that have turned into housing, right? And even there's a shortage there. So most of our agricultural operations that we do are off reserve. And that's also something that we're also trying to push to communities is, so there's this, I don't know the exact numbers, I'm not going to get it right, but, you know, I think FCC has the stat, and they said that, I think it's by 2030, I'm going to get it wrong no matter what I say, but by 2030, it's like 60% of our farms are retiring. right? So then the other side to this is, well, we're trying to pitch also that how come our First Nations aren't being the ones in line to buy these farms?
Yes.
Right? And, yes. And you know, if, because like you're saying, you know, it's an established farm is like so capital intensive, right? But First Nation communities have more opportunities, I think, to borrow than First Nation individual. And then it's, you know, how do we turn that kind of opportunity into, you know, a larger operation or something that then supports the community and then supports food production?
Wow, that's a really brilliant policy idea, because it kind of closes the loop in terms of, on the one hand, addressing the aging, the demographic crisis that affects farmers right across the country, that they don't really have succession in place. They don't have people who want to take over. And yet First Nations have the opposite demographic issue, that there's lots of young people and really a desire to create opportunities for work, for engagement. I mean, what a way to not only address the kind of succession and demographics, but also empower First Nations as key players through the agricultural sector. I mean, Camden, I got a joke. You got any other brilliant policy ideas sitting around on your table that you could share with us?
No, well, I mean, a lot of that idea came from, you know, I'm in the same position as most, right, where my parents have the farm and my plan was to take it over. And, you know, technically there's nothing I can do on that farm that will make the payment. Right. So it's like, well, you know, and it's not a big farm, right? 100 acres, you know, which is kind of the no man's land of, you know, what do you do here? You know, I can't have enough animals. I can't grow enough crops, you know, to then just, and we're talking Southern Ontario, right, to justify the $1.5 million that it's worth. But with that said, a First Nation, like, I'm talking First Nation communities looking at bigger operations. And, you know, like, I know there's opportunities coming up every day in terms of greenhouse facilities. I know there's a bison farm, like those kind of things. And you know, it's working out how, you know, how we get those First Nations stepping in and saying, how do we get this, and then how do we take it to the next level, with also, you know, the other big thing that we're working on is how do we get training in place, right? Because it's not like, you know, these, and even for you know, for anyone, right? It's, you can't, a big thing is, you know, there's not a ton of agriculture education, and it's not super specific. So it's, you know, how do you get someone that may be interested in agriculture, and then the community buys, let's say, a large dairy operation? You know, it's like, well, how do we get those on a fast track training? Or is there a possibility where we say, hey, we're going to buy this farm off you guys as a community, but you guys have to stay for 2 years and we'll pay you to train us, right? To so it doesn't fall flat on its face after we buy it, right? And a lot of that's passed down, you know, usually generation to generation, right? But if we're looking at a first generation getting into it, you know, that's one of the challenges. And I think one of the other positives to commercial scale is one of the big things with what we've seen over the years is, well, we're not, communities are saying, well, we're not getting people that are, or we're not getting enough employees to work for us and those kind of things. And it's, well, you, what are you paying them, right? Like, for example, in our community, the cannabis boom was huge, and even for our organization, we're looking for employees, and it's like, well, why would I come work for you when I can go stand in a pot shop and make $50 an hour cash? And it's like, you know, so there's this thing where it's like commercial scale.
And maybe smoke on the job, too.
and smoke all day on the job, exactly. Where it's, you know, we have to be able to create operations that are going to provide a wage that justifies people being there, right? So it's almost too, so now we have to go commercial scale, right?
I do want to speak to scale, but you brought something up when you mentioned mining that I think is really important. And it gets to the kind of literacy that exists within a community or specifically within leadership, in that because mining is such a hot topic here in Ontario, and it's certainly getting a lot of attention, people learn about it, right? They think about the opportunities, the infrastructure opportunities, the employment opportunities, the broader community concerns. But agriculture, on the other hand, kind of gets taken for granted. It's the thing we sort of, you know, like our food, just assume it's going to be there. How do we foster that kind of agricultural literacy, especially amongst leaders, so that they start recognizing the kind of opportunities that exist, both in the agricultural sector, but as we mentioned earlier, in terms of innovation within the agricultural sector, so that farming and agriculture kind of has the same appeal or the same profile as the mining sector?
And I think it starts back with education, right? Like, I went to the type of high school that, you know, the kids, the dairy farmers, wore their barn boots, right, to school, kind of place. And they were just there because their parents made them there, and they couldn't wait to, you know, be done with school just to work on the farm all day, kind of thing. But I was in that high school, and, you know, I didn't learn anything about agriculture, technically. It's not a topic, or not, like, unless you're doing a co-op and going and working on a farm, it's not really something that is pushed or even talked about. But it's, someone told me the other day, so, and I don't know if you follow the news, but I live in Tainanaga, and, you know, we had the 100-some-odd million-dollar pot bust, right? All the illegal pot busts in the community, and all these greenhouses, all these things. And then I was talking to somebody, and they're like, you know what, you know, it's amazing they were growing it, those kind of things, but they're like, at the current price, they would have made more money growing basil plants.
Yes.
Right? And it's like, well, why can't we, you know, because a basil plant technically goes for more than a pot plant right now. So they're like, if they grew that many basil plants, they actually would have made more money and not gone to jail. So I think it's just education in, you know, we all go to the store and see the prices and pay, you know, $10 for this basil plant or whatever, right? But it never occurs, well, if I grew, you know, a million of these, right? So I think it's just education in that, you know, food's not going to go away ever. You know, or the need for food. So it's like, how do we educate and get to the point? Like, another story is, we had a client that agriculture, loved agriculture, went to school for agriculture, and he wanted to become a potato farmer in Toronto. And we're like, not gonna happen. And, but he did it. He did it, right? And he bought all the equipment, and he talked to all the big farmers in the area, and he rotationally did 10 acres every year by himself of potatoes. And his motto to the grocery store was, I will harvest the potatoes and get them to your grocery store in less than 12 hours. Like, they're out of the ground and in your grocery store cleaned in less than 10 hours or 12 hours. And he made over $100,000 a year doing that on 10 acres of potatoes. So it's like, there's opportunities, because, you know, all the other potatoes come from who knows where. You know, he advertised, you know, no chemicals, pick that day, like, you can't get anything fresher. And he sold for a premium price and made a ton of money. But it's like, if you're not in it, you don't know that.
Although I think even if you are in it, that doesn't mean you know it. The nature of the agricultural sector is it's really complicated. It's wide, broad, diverse. I mean, just your point about recognizing that Basil will get you a better margin than, say, growing marijuana plants. I mean, that's pretty significant. And it's not the type of thing that people really think about. I think part of it reflects how, as the industry has become consolidated, there just aren't enough people experimenting, thinking, doing crazy things. And maybe that's the benefit of not just having communities engage the sector, but of having new actors that they'll think of new stuff to try.
Yeah, and that's a good question, right? And that's kind of what we're kind of pondering, right? Like, how do we... You know, because how do we get the youth involved? How do we get the kids involved in showing them that, you know, because they're seeing the headline, you know, oh, there's, you know, 12 million, whatever it was, right? X million, 100, it was like 120 some million worth of pot plants. They're like, oh, look at the money in pot, right? And it's like, you know, but no one's saying, you know, the article, you know, that could have been 250 million in basil, you know, like... But yeah, it's, and to your point as well, right? Like, the guy that does the potatoes, no big potato farmer is going to be doing that. You know, they're going to harvest them. They're going to put the chemicals on them. You know, so there is opportunity. Like, there is opportunities for the small guys. And I'm not saying that, you know, like that guy that does the 10 acres of potatoes, he works like a madman, right? Like, he harvests in the morning, he washes them all, bags them all, drives them to the store himself. Like, it's a one-man show. But he loves it, right? So it's also, how do we create that love for agriculture?
I think part of what I'm hearing in your remarks is a different approach to scale. And as we mentioned earlier, you know, scale is obviously a huge focus for the agricultural sector. Everyone wants to scale, to focus on exports, to be able to afford the equipment, do the kind of operations that you can't do if, to your point, you only have 100 acres. But you're kind of describing, a community-centric model of scale where it's not just larger operations, but multiple communities cooperating together, you know, sharing different elements of what would make value-added production. I'd love to hear you unpack that a little.
No, for sure. And that was kind of another thought we had is, you know, because we talked, you know, we get approached by Metro and Sobeys and the Foodlands, right? We get calls and say, hey, we need, you know, a pile of this, right? And it's like, well, we have no one growing that much. And even if we compiled, let's say, all of our guys, they're not going to grow that much. But I do think that potentially, because another question is, you know, from a community asking us, well, who are we going to sell it to, right? Like, we're going to grow all this and, you know, our community can't buy it all. Like, so the thought was, you know, if we got moving forward, there's power in creating a brand, right? Like, you know, who's the community that's maybe the, you know, there's tons of small communities that have no land. It's like, well, put up a warehouse and you package everything, right? Like, it's under one brand, and then it goes from there to whoever the buyer is, right? But that's, I mean, that would be the end goal, and we're still at step one, but no, I definitely think there's, you know, I think there would be, my opinion, a premium price on, you know, like, oh, we knew this. They look for the logo or the brand, and it's, we know that was grown by a First Nation community, and, you know, there could be a story behind it and what community it came from and the care that went into it or how it was grown, and
I totally agree. And if we look at, for example, how consumers have treated organic food in the marketplace, whether as a category or specific brands within it, it does suggest that if there was a First Nations affiliated brand or a broader Indigenous brand in the marketplace, that a lot of Canadians would feel really good supporting it and kind of speak to the value and perception that can be played by empowering these communities to be part of the sector.
Well, and the other thought too was, and this, I have taken this from another colleague, this is not my idea, but he was saying his vision in this kind of thing is, you know, you go to every grocery store and there's an international aisle, right? Or two international aisles. He goes, but there's no Indigenous aisle, right? In any grocery store, right? You're lucky to even get one Indigenous brand in the store, but because it's hard, right? It's definitely hard. But his vision is to have a full, you know, Indigenous aisle in, you know, whatever chain he's talking to, right? But like it's definitely there's opportunity and everyone's open to the idea. It's just how do we get the production? How do we get the people interested? The communities interested? And start getting production going, right? And that's where we're kind of putting the pieces together, but it's definitely not easy, right? Like there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle: training, capital, getting a community to come together.
I would certainly love to have you back to talk more about those pieces and the way in which they kind of start connecting together. And I've certainly benefited from, you know, your wisdom, your perspective in terms of what's happening across the sector. You know, two questions before we end. The first, is there anything that we haven't talked about that we should before we conclude?
Well, I'll just put one other thing that we are working on that we would have to talk about next time we're on the call is we are working part of this bigger idea is we have started conversations with the quota holders, the quota, what do you call them, boards,
or like dairy and chickens,
yeah, dairy,
and turkey,
chicken,
that sort of stuff,
kind of things, and how that would play, you know, how do we get First Nations in holding quota. You know, we're all familiar kind of with the quota world, and in some instances, when quota came out, it was removed from First Nation people that held, not held it, but that were producers, right? There's a couple people in our community that were dairy farmers at the time, and they weren't eligible for quota because they were First Nation. So it's how do we, you know, in the spirit of reconciliation, how do we get some communities involved in that world? So that's in the works, but a great opportunity, right, for some communities to be in those sectors, and it's kind of where the kind of another little brief story is which got me kind of interested in communities doing this is we have a client that is a chicken holder and raises his birds, his contracts with Costco. And if we've all been to Costco, you know, they raise, or like, you know, those chickens are kind of small turkeys in size, right? But I was talking to him and I said, well, you know, you just put the feed out and chickens eat, right? So what happens if a chicken doesn't meet the Costco 20-pound, you know, 25-pound benchmark to be a Costco chicken? And he goes, well, they don't want them. They just get killed. It's garbage, you know? So you know, if a First Nation community had that contract, how many 18-pound chickens could be just in the community? Right? So it's there's some exciting things on that side, but
right on. Now, our last question that I'm now starting to ask every guest we have on the show is, who are some leaders that you want to shout out to? People who deserve more attention, that we should be paying attention to, or that you just want to show some respect towards?
Oh, I mean, a big one that's done some big thing in the ag world is Monica James at FCC. She's kind of if you're familiar, they've started their indigenous branch of FCC, and that's kind of where we've connected a lot and have moved a lot of things forward with FCC, and they've definitely jumped on board and kind of have, let's say, have our back in terms of the capital side, and we're starting to work with them. Just the NCIAF is doing some great things there as well.
Awesome. Thanks, Camden. And I really appreciate you coming on the show. We definitely have to get you back. You know, you evoked the word reconciliation. And while on the one hand, I think encouraging and supporting the expansion of Indigenous agriculture is a great example of that. But I also think it's a leadership opportunity, because as you've demonstrated today, I think there's a lot that we can be learning from First Nations who engage farming, who engage the food sector, and do so on terms of their own that match their culture and that bring innovation, I think, that we can all learn from. So thank you very much.
No, definitely. Like, we're just at the beginning of this kind of, say, journey in how we really become agricultural, I want to call it, leaders, right, in the province. And yeah, it'd be great to reconnect and see where we're at in a year's time or so, and
right on.
Some of the projects we actually got on the go.
Before we close, I want to return to something that surfaced several times in this conversation: the difference between talking about opportunity and actually building the conditions that make opportunity possible. What Camden helped illuminate is that Indigenous agriculture in Canada isn't just about producing food. It's about building institutions, building access to capital, and building the capacity for communities to participate in an industry that has become increasingly complex and capital intensive. Agriculture today rewards scale, coordination, and long-term investment. And those realities shape what kinds of projects are possible and how they need to be structured. But what also comes through clearly is that there is real momentum. Across First Nations communities, there's growing interest in agriculture, in agribusiness, and in the broader food economy. And organizations like First Nations Agriculture and Finance Ontario are working in the middle of that space, helping translate ambition into viable projects, helping communities navigate financing, and helping new producers find their footing in a sector that can be very difficult to enter. For the rest of the agri-food sector, there's an important lesson here as well. Indigenous agriculture is not just a social initiative or a policy conversation. It's an emerging part of the economic landscape of Canadian agriculture. And as Camden pointed out, the question going forward is not simply whether Indigenous communities will participate, but how they will shape the sector as that participation grows. Camden, thank you for sharing your perspective and for giving us a clear picture of the work underway to support not only First Nations producers, but the agricultural sector as a whole when we learn from each other and embrace the diverse opportunities that are in front of us. And of course, to everyone listening, thanks for joining us for another episode of The Future Herd. I'm Jesse Hirsch. I'll see you next time.